Okay, we're going to go ahead and get started right on time. Welcome, everybody. I am Greg Dixon. I'm an assistant professor of music here at DigiPen. And I'm really excited that you're all here for our meeting today, and especially would like to welcome our IEEE members here. I'm going to go ahead and start off by introducing the chair of IEEE, Adam Loper. He's going to make a few brief remarks.
Yes, just to clarify, that's the chair of the Signal Processing Society. We have the chair of the section here, Alan. So I just wanted to briefly speak about what we're kind of thinking in the future here. So as of yet, we don't have any presenters planned for the rest of the year. I figure holidays are going on and that sort of thing. But early next year, January, I'm thinking, we're going to have Zudong do a talk on natural language processing from Zudong's at Microsoft. He's one of the major contributors to speech recognition, and he contributed to SAPI, the speech API, in the early 90s. So so that's what we have planned for presenters so far, but I was hoping to do something with some maybe some roundtable discussions or some paper reviews, something a little more informal like that. So maybe we'll put that in before the end of the year here. But right now, I'm the only person volunteering on the committee. So we really need volunteers if anybody's interested in getting involved in that. So the main method of communication right now is going to be through the IEEE section website. So and the e-notices. So I'll send out a poll with some different ideas about discussion possibilities there, maybe doing some kind of tutorial thing. But yeah, that's what we've got slated, so stay posted.
Thanks, Adam. At this point, I'd like to introduce Rick Chin.
I think we're going to skip the usual introduction because we're a little short on time. I'll take just a brief moment to recognize Jeff Emmerich, who passed away yesterday, age of 72, and Siegfried Linkwitz, the Linkwitz of Linkwitz-Riley crossover fame. He passed away in the last month, and he had a long battle with Mr. C. I think that's all I have. Greg?
Okay, thanks a lot, Rick. At this point in time, I'd like to introduce our two speakers tonight. First off, we have J.J. Johnston. J.J.
With a T.
I said Johnston, right? Okay. He has a rich history in audio, working for 26 years at AT&T Bell Labs. He is one of the first investigators in the field of perceptual audio coding, and has helped invent many different codecs for audio. He's a expert in the field of auditory perception of sound fields, and JJ is an IEEE fellow, an AES fellow, New Jersey Inventor of the Year, and many other awards.
You can stop.
Okay, I'm just going to mention, in 2012, he presented the Heiser Lecture at the AES 133 Convention. We're very honored to have him with us tonight presenting. In addition, we're also very happy to introduce Bob Smith. Bob has been working for the past 20 years doing acoustic research at Stryker Physiocontrol and working on speech intelligibility for medical devices, voice recording systems. And currently, Bob is working doing analysis on hardware and software acoustic audio measurement systems to assess how they vary and to the degree they converge on similar results. So without further ado, J.J. Johnston.
Divers might be a better choice. So I'm going to talk about basically how things are produced. I'm going to show a bunch of slides. I'm going to explain what's in the slides in a minute. One thing to remember, all of these slides are taken from production CDs digitally copied. People actually did this. And furthermore, most of them are like the worst in the example instead of the better examples. So, having said that, I have to point out a few things about digital. If you clip digitally all those out-of-band harmonics alias right back into the passband. This is not a good thing. That means if you clip a 15 kilohertz sine wave and you clip it asymmetrically, you're going to see an alias from 30 kilohertz down back down into the passband. You're going to see one from 45 back down into the passband, and so on and so on and so on. This is ugly. We will play something in a minute. It's ugly, right, Greg?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So it's just the process is easily described mathematically, but not politely described in terms of perception. Sounds horrible.
And what frequencies would those generate?
Well, you just figure out whatever the aliasing frequency is. So if it's a CD, and say if you have 30 kilohertz, you figure 2205 minus 30. You can throw away the sign. There's your alias,
and
which is whatever 30 minus 2205 is, 8 kilohertz or something like that. More to the point, I did an example where I took the sampling frequency is 44.1 kilohertz, subtracted 1 kilohertz, and divided it by 3. I did that for what I'm going to play for you, because that means that the first distortion alias comes into kilohertz, and you will hear it. You may wish you didn't, but you will hear it. Okay. Now, on top of that, DACs really don't like, a lot of DACs really don't like intersample overs. Some DACs actually just drop you by 6 dB, drop you by a bit. That's nice of them to do that because it's a lot better than what some of the other DACs do, which is have fits inside of their digital arithmetic. And I can't describe why they do what they do. I'll just describe it as stuff. You may assume that this is not good stuff. I don't think Bob is going to play you an example, but something that spreads the spectrum from 75 hertz up to 10 kilohertz around every sharp transition is just not. Basically, it puts in a crunch every time you get in your sample over. Some DACs do. It's a scary thing. Yeah?
And it's not just the DAC chip, but the analog circuitry. Even if the DAC chip were perfect, the analog circuitry after it could.
Yes, but if that happens, it only clips.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
there we go.
And
there,
yes, and okay, and now that's analog clipping as well as digital, so it's really not that awful. But when I say only clips, you understand that's called faint praise, right? Yeah. Okay. And then when you put any of these through a codec, you're going to gain between a few tenths of a dB and a dB more in terms of peak level. And then that's all going to go through the rest of the system. Good luck with that. You had a question.
Full scale?
You got what?
What does that mean?
Full scale is the largest and smallest, the most negative and most positive digital signals.
Okay.
You know, 0 dB full scale.
Okay.
So, find the right key. On top of this, we observe other things. We find things that have people have used quantizers that have massive numbers and missing codes. One example I have is three out of four codes in a DAC are missing. Literally. That's 16 bits, is 14 bits. Dithering omitted. I'll show you an absolutely phenomenal whopper that comes off of a really popular track. I'm not allowed to name the track, but it's special in so many ways that I don't know what to say. It's special. We had overcompression. This is a different problem in that it just makes things sound crappy, but if you overcompress and then you put in intersample overs and you clip the crap out of it, basically you've assured yourself two things. One, it's going to be really fatiguing to listen to, and two, you have no idea what's going to happen when you put it out of an actual D-to-A converter in the customer's system. And you really, presumably, even if you're going for artistic distortion, presumably you'd like to know what kind, right? So, what's this about clipping and aliasing and so on? Okay, this is the sine wave at 6.7 kilohertz. It's rounded a little bit, but okay. This is the spectrum of the original sine wave. This is 0 to half the sampling rate.
Oh.
Thank you, Bill Gates.
Bugger off.
Restart options on.
So overbearing.
That's not helpful.
Let's restart.
We could all be getting text messages.
Don't even start yet. I hope I made that go away. If not, I'm just going to stand here and swear. Okay, so this is what you would expect for the spectrum of a sine wave, right? One line. Okay, now what I've done is I just clipped this at plus or minus a half. I just clipped this. Yes. Now you notice you have the line where you expect it. This is the third harmonic, which is what happened. You get third harmonic when you use symmetric clipping. So you have lots of energy here. You go up here, you have the fifth harmonic. You have the seventh harmonic. You have the ninth harmonic. It just keeps going and going and going. And now we have really terrible sounds for you to listen to. So play the original. That's the one titled Clean. Okay, this has a high frequency thing, unpleasant high frequency tone, and that's it. You may have to move your head back and forth to hear it. If you don't hear it, it doesn't matter. The point being is it's a high-pitched tone. And that's all you need to know. And only one frequency. You got it, Ray?
It's there. Yep.
Okay. And then we're going to play the clip version. You have to turn the gain up for that, Ray. Notice now it sounds a lot more like a 1 kHz sine wave. It's not supposed to sound like that, but that is literally what happens when you clip it. The predominant thing you hear in an average room then is going to be 1 kHz, and that is 6.67 kHz. And if you take a look here, going back a slide, that doesn't look anything like a harmonic series, does it? If you do that, now the thing is, this is what happens when you do it the one tone. When you do it the complex signal, you get IM products, intermodulation distortion products everywhere. And if you want to sound like you're doing, what do they call that, a version where they do take these soft rock ballads and do it hyper-compressed, I forget, the band, like something like Coven, I think, is one of the bands. If you want to make it sound like that, okay, your choice. But I hope it still comes out that way when you put it through the customer stack. And I think this is probably a safe statement. Was that second thing a little unpleasant?
Unfortunately,
it
was turned down.
I can't hear it.
Well, now it's off.
Want to hear it again? Second one?
Just play the second and turn it up a little bit. Okay, everybody's witching now. You can stop it. So that's what happens. Now, this leads directly to mathematics. If you're going to distort your signal, you have to figure out the mathematical polynomial order of the signal. Those of you who don't know what that is, sorry, we're not going to do that in one day. But you have to upsample by a certain amount, which is given by this. Then you distort, and then you downsample. If you do that, you will not get anything folding back. Now, this looks like a funny number, but what happens is, say, if you oversample by 2, that means you can put aliasing into the second copy of the spectrum, and then fold it over into the third copy of the spectrum, and the oversampling will remove it when you do the reconstruction. So you can do this, but basically, if you don't want stuff coming out places you never expected it, and by the way, I used to have an example of a Glockenspiel that did this. It was breathtaking, because one of the things, Glockenspiels have 2 notes, 2 clones. It came out with this modulated 130 Hz thing. It was really pleasant. I don't have that demonstration anymore. I don't own that material, so I can't make it. But this is what happens when you don't properly clip. Intersample overs. If you have a couple of successive values, either at positive or negative max, that almost always, not always, means that the level between those 2 samples goes over 1 or minus 1. Now, DACs that are properly constructed in my brain think that they should handle this. Fat chance. I'm not going to show you that. Bob is going to show you this stuff. You're going to look at some of this stuff and you're going to ask, what was that? And the only way we'll ever find out is by putting probes onto the IC and trying to figure it out. But whatever it is, you don't want it. So intersample overs are a problem. Not all DACs fail there. What happens is, I happen to know, like Windows prevents this by just basically jamming in a limiter when you hit this situation. Hello?
Hello.
Hi, is the limiter still there?
Yes, it certainly is.
Gee, wonder why.
There's a reason for that being there.
Yes, I remember that argument. Well, it wasn't with Elliot either. But it's still there. Windows takes it. Apple does a similar thing. They will catch some of this stuff and squash it. It's not the best way for signal-to-noise ratio, but it's a great deal better than basically exploding in the user's ear, which is not an acceptable outcome.
I think
we did that because you told us to. But Bob will show you this. I can't really describe what some of these DACs do, but it ain't pretty. Okay, the classic example. Okay, this is just plus, plus, minus, minus, plus, plus, minus, minus. Now, this is a little bit extreme because this is sort of the theoretical max. Not quite, but within that much of the theoretical max. If you add in a third harmonic, you can get another tenth. If you add in fifth. But this is almost a theoretical max. And if you look here, this goes up to 1.4. This is a tone you never want to play into your DAC. It's that simple. But this is how you get intersample overs. Once you take and you filter out that square wave, what you find out is that you have the square wave has harmonics that are out of phase, a third and fifth harmonics that are out of phase. When you filter the third and fifth harmonics out, now it peaks. That's an intersample over. Despite 40% of the audio literature, they really do exist. And they are a problem. So what do you do? Well, happens. In some DACs, the oversampling arithmetic fails. You'll see that. Some cases, the DACs will clip. The analog parts of the DAC will clip. Like I said, this will give you an obvious clip. Sounds like obvious clipping. That's actually the better outcome of these two. That's a much better outcome. I don't like it, but it's a better outcome. In some DACs, the output amplifier goes nuts. This tends to put in cheap, chirps and tweets and crunches. This one, at least in the ones we did, we don't seem to see. It seems to have not been present in the current crop of DACs we have. Thank you. It was definitely present in DACs 10 years ago. I am extremely sure of that. Some do it right. But the whole point here is if you're producing this, you want to produce it so that you know what the person at the other end is going to hear, right? And if you're going to do this stuff, you have no idea what they're going to hear when you get close to maximum. It's going to explode. So now let's talk about what else you can go wrong. Well, you can add in processing. You have EQ, compensation. Interestingly, we had found a track where if you put in a high-pass filter, the phase shift in the high-pass filter, which was set at 5 hertz, was enough to take it from plus and minus 1 to plus and minus 1.5. Because there was a whole bunch of scurry synthesis going on at low frequencies, and changing the phases meant instead of subtracting, they added. Okay? You can do that. Any kind of codec, any kind of non-lossy codec, will increase your level. It doesn't actually increase the level everywhere. On average, it will actually slightly decrease the RMS value, but it will increase the peaks. It is an unavoidable mathematical consequence. There's just no debate to have about that. It's math. And yes, we do build in that stuff, but then we have to change the overall system gain. So it goes. It's better than exploding. And soft clipping at low frequencies, at least, can do well. Soft clipping at high frequencies is one of those things that has too high of an order. And again, stuff happens. Less sophisticated coding, things like ADPCM or some of the really low-rate coders, they can do amazing amounts of stuff in this that in terms of this realm of overload can just be horrible. And lossless coders don't do it, but you get a higher bit rate. And you still, if you've got intersample overs, you've got intersample overs, they're just not as big. And I actually ran into a previous incarnation of a lossless codec where they used integer arithmetic and they wrapped. Now, what that means that plus 1 goes to minus 1. Now, the codec was actually still lossless, but it drove the predictor circuit incredibly nuts, and basically you got negative compression. So even if it comes out right, you can mess up your bit rate. And I will say, if you crypt the crap out of something and then you put it into a perceptual codec, you will push the rate of that up too. It's either the rate will go up or the quality will go down. Take your choice.
You want to wait an hour. Your bill's calling.
No! Will you stop that? Okay. I guess I have a tight fuse here. Okay. What else happens? Well, in addition to breaking things, it raises the bit rates for codecs. It will. You're adding more harmonics, you have to code more stuff. Even if they're not harmonics, you still have to code them because that's what it's supposed to sound like what you made. Clipping the input, more bits, it makes it loud. I don't think that's good. Some people do. And it doesn't, you know, loud doesn't mean good. I'm sorry, it doesn't. There's an interesting thing that, here, well, if you play two things and one of them's a tenth of a dB louder, everybody thinks it sounds better. That's true. And if you do another tenth of a dB, it will compare better to the one that's one-tenth of a dB. The two-tenths of a dB will sound louder. But after you do that a couple of times, you compare it to the original may sound better than the one that's 2 dB louder. It is not a transitive process. Every time you increment a little bit, it sounds better. You go too far, it may sound worse. And that's just life. Another real life. Okay, now you play unclipped, and this is reasonable. This is a real, honest-to-God woodwind with the leaky G-pad.
Can
I
play that one more
time? Just play it again. Okay, now play the clip version. That's a flute, but there's not much clip. There's not much clipping in there, but that's the kind of thing. I don't know what you call that second instrument. What do you think of that second instrument? Does it sound good?
Kazoo.
Yeah. You can clip a flute and turn it into a kazoo. I'm not sure that's your goal. But that's the kind of things that will happen. Do you want to do it? I mean, that's an artistic choice. If you want to do it as an artistic choice, I won't stop you. But remember, that's what you're doing. Okay, now I'm going to show you some measurements. I'm going to have to do some explaining here. There are three plots, top to bottom. The first one is a histogram. How many people know what a histogram is? Okay, how many people want me to explain it? Other than Steve, because he knows what a histogram is. A histogram basically says the horizontal scale is level. In this case, it's level between minus max and plus max, where the minus one is minus max, the plus one is plus max. The vertical scale is probability. It says, what is the chance of getting this code on your CD? Now, there's 65536 codes available on the CD. Each one of them, we measure it for each one of them. Now, since we're plotting this on a screen, it's much, much narrower than 65536. We break it into sections. For each of the section, we code the most and least likely. We show, so you'll see a thick line is the most and least likely in that little range of things that you're going to see in the histogram. There's two histograms. The red one is the actual measured levels in the CD track. The blue one is the histogram of the 5x oversampled track. So we're just searching here for intersample overs. 5x is probably about as good as you need. You can get maybe a 1/100th by going to 7x, but 5x is pretty much all you need. And the second one is also a histogram, but this case, the horizontal scale is an arbitrary loudness scale. It's not level. It's not intensity, it's loudness. I've done the loudness versus intensity talk here about a dozen times. I hope I don't have to talk about that one, but it's measuring the perceptual, since it's measuring the sensation level, not the energy of the air. And the third plot is a histogram of something called the spectral flatness measure. I'm not even going to try to explain why I use this, except to say that if it's the spectral flatness measure is zero, it's white noise. If it's infinite, it's a sine wave. Basically, it's a measure of the spectral slope. The IEEE people will be much more familiar with it than the AES people, but let's just say the lower the spectral flatness measure, the easier it is to code the signal. Because what it does measure, among other things, is how predictable the signal is. And I measured this. That was primarily for my own interest, but it's in the program, so I run it and I look at it. But You can, we'll mostly ignore that for the purpose of talking about overload. So the histogram, like I said, shows each datum falling into a particular bin. The bins are one level wide. Then when we plot it, we combine some number of bins, if you will, into a meta bin, and we plot both the largest and smallest. For the first plot, each bin is one, and for the second and third, the bins are one unit. These units are arbitrary. The second one is arbitrary units, the third one is dB. Because there's not things, like I said, the top and the bottom. This can also show other things beyond overload in this sample. Overs, and yes, we will see those. And finally, peaks, if you have a peak in that first histogram at plus and minus one, that's clipping. That's a classic example of clipping. Having said that, let's look at something. This is an orchestral recording made quite reasonably. You notice in the middle, where most of the levels are, there's no drops to zero. There are some drops to zero when you get close to the peaks, but you should expect that because unless the track was, 4 hours long, the probability of hitting those, getting every level is just zero. So you're going to see a little dips, but it doesn't get anywhere near intersample overs. You can't even see the blue true peak because it's right under the red. Okay, this is good. Loudness, it's not very loud, but it's got a very large loudness ratio, which implies 39 dB dynamic range, and it's quite a dynamic little piece of music. You can tell there's a quiet part and a loud part right there. Forget the spectral flatness measure for this talk. Okay, but there's no overload. There's a few missing codes, but they should be there. You would expect this when you're getting close to the end of a distribution that you just don't hit all the bins. So let's look at something else. This is a low-level recording made in a home studio by somebody who wasn't writing their gain. The first thing they did to get their level up is they multiplied all the samples by four. So three out of every four levels in the PC, the CD, are missing. There's no dithering involved. That's the first thing. The second thing is, the levels are a little bit low, but this is just showing what happens when you have missing. This is what it looks like when you have missing codes in the ADD. If you see this in your recording, you're missing levels. It could be due to processing. It could be due to the ADD, but you don't want to see this. Out here, at these tails, it's okay. You really shouldn't see that in the middle. So that is things you can spot here that aren't overload. And now we will go to this. I don't know what else to say except what? First off, you notice that there are periodic missing codes. They are not at binary levels. What happened is somebody took a signal that was almost maxed out, multiplied it by a very small number to max it out, very small number greater than one, just slightly greater than one, and did not dither. That is the only way you get that pattern.
And those are the lines.
Those are the vertical lines, yes. Yeah. More to the point, the max and min are the second and third most common points in this distribution. That isn't just clipping. That is a lot of clipping. And if you look at the intersample overs, which are the blue, it's got 3 dB worth of intersample overs. Bob put this particular track. This, by the way, is a commercial, popular commercial track. I'm not going to say what, but it's a popular commercial track. Bob put this through one of his DACs. He's got some pretty pictures here. But this is more or less, in a nutshell, what you shouldn't see. This has everything in it you shouldn't see. It's got missing codes, it's got massive clipping, it's got massive intersample overs. Don't do this. It's not an artistic choice. You put this through two different DACs, you're going to get two different things out of it.
JJ, yeah? Is this something that you could get with Pro Tools, and you import a 16-bit file,
yeah,
and you decide, I want to normalize this file, which boosts the gain, and it only boosts it by a little bit, and
okay,
then re-quantize back to 16-bit file to write.
Well, that's what they did, but somehow the dithering was missing there.
Yeah, the dithering's missing, and there are numbers that you'll never get.
Okay, now this is a different exercise of intersample overs. Again, you will not, now if you notice that this part here is very well populated, there's not much fuzz, and you notice it doesn't have a very steep slope. In general, collections of sine waves have something like a log normal slope. This is more like flat. This is spectacularly awful production, and you notice it also has huge... Now, this is interesting. This is not a track. But you notice this isn't... Just to point out, this is not clipped at max. This is clipped inside of max. But the intersample overs are still enormous. Now, the thing that's interesting about this is a transcription of somebody's master tape. You can't do this on tape. This does not exist on tape. So somebody did this after they transcribed the master tape. I don't know. I probably don't want ever to find out. It's wrong. And you also notice here, if you look at the peak to RMS ratio is 2.6. That's a little over 6 dB. I mean, that's less than white noise. I don't know what else to say. That isn't a peak to RMS ratio. That's a... Pretty much the entire signal is a flat bar in your screen. Okay, and then somebody who kind of did it right. They clipped the crap out of this. You notice how high those spikes are, right? But they clipped it inside the digital dynamic range so that the intersample overs don't go over. So now that's an interesting tactic, but it's okay, right? It doesn't, at least it's not going to break the DAC. But that is literally what they've done here. They have, and if you look, you can't tell from the plot right here, but there's one sample that's very, very, very close to plus one. So they literally reduced the gain until the intersample overs were eliminated. Okay, they did it. It's a technique.
How does it sound?
This particular thing is being an old person, I'd say it's sort of in the metal genre. So it sounds like it should. I mean, it sounds like metal. But at least this will come out of your system and then somebody else's system and sound like the same thing. But it is an interesting approach. They actually limited the signal so that the intersample overs didn't happen. And I did have to look hard for this. This is not the only example.
You
mean,
did it on purpose for that effect, or it just came out that way?
Well, all I can say, Elliot, is an entire album was like this. And I don't think that the producers of this well-known band did this by accident. Okay? Yeah?
JJ, are you generating these plots using that MATLAB?
I'm using MATLAB, or you can, this runs in Octave as well.
Yeah. Is that script that you generated?
Bob has a version of the current script.
That runs in Octave. I sanitize it for Octave's use.
Okay, and you're welcome to give that away. I mean, okay. That's fine.
Ask me for it, and I'll get you the script.
Yeah, and you know, and you can look at a track and see what you got. This was not unique. It wasn't the only album like this. There are a lot of things produced like this. So somebody's paying sort of attention. Yeah.
I've been seeing a lot of plugins advertised that say that they will detect intersample overs, and I wonder if someone built the plugin that just says. Here, you can,
it sure looks like it.
Turn it up to maximum and we'll take care of that for you.
It sure looks like it. That's not, I mean, it's not evil. It means that DACs aren't going to explode on you. And this is an old rock group. The person who runs it now is into 44-channel guitars flying at you from all people in the rooms. This is from his first band. This was taken off a master tape. Now I notice there's a little bit of clipping in it, but it's not much. And you notice the second half of that has some missing spots, which is what you should expect. They just didn't need to clip this. This would have been fine if they didn't clip it at all. The other thing is, if you take a look, it actually has a dynamic range over 10 dB, which is sort of a miracle for some of these tracks. And it has a peak to RMS ratio of 6. which is also pretty good. Then that particular thing sounds pretty good. I cannot hear the clipping on this one. It's all on bass notes, and it's already got, you know, lots of distortion in a bass guitar. So, you know, okay, it doesn't sound so bad. Because this is not, all the distortion is on low frequency stuff. It's not going to do that nasty aliasing trick. And it clearly hasn't been put through an Optimod. So, I put this one up just because it's interesting. This has a ton of missing codes. I don't know exactly what's going on here. But also, if you walk up here, and you can't maybe see it back there, but this has four different clipping levels in it. It's clear that they took some tracks and clipped them and then reduced the gain and added them to other tracks and then clipped it again. I got no words. And it sounds clipped. You know, that sort of sounds like it's in a tube thing. This is clipped. This is clipped, even though it doesn't even get close to having intersample overs. It sounds clipped. Yeah. I don't know what they're doing. And another one. This is something that was very popular in the early 2000s. And you can see, again, you have the same problem. You see two different spots it's clipped in the end. You see one, two, three places it's clipped on that end, and it has some intersample overs. So this is just, I just put these up just to give you a survey of what's out there. None of these, all right, I didn't pick the extremes. I just went through and picked things. So there's probably stuff out there that's much worse. But I literally did not go through 600 tracks and find the worst ones. I just picked ones out that exhibited things. So there's probably worse out there. Although the one, that first one, I'm not sure how you could do much worse. Yeah?
So the spike at zero is nothing to worry about.
The spike at zero, it should be the most common level.
Silence,
it should be. But the thing is, this doesn't have a lot. But the thing is, there's different clipping levels.
Is that because you did the whole album and maybe different songs?
No, this is one track off of an album. Okay. You know, and what can I say? We still suffer from that song today. And finally, this is over the whole corpus. So this shows you all of the extremes. Think over all of all of the stuff. This is the whole corpus, not one track. This is the whole 600 some tracks. And you got to admit, this just proves, I don't know where some of these really bad ones come from. I didn't bother to look, but you got to admit, I just told the computer to go through the whole 600 tracks and went away to lunch, you know. And this is what you get. It's actually kind of depressing in a way. And with that, I only have a couple more things to say. Any lossy codec. Okay, anybody that's producing anything today is going to send this stuff through a lossy codec, right? Everybody is going to. It's going to make it even worse. Give us some headroom. 1 dB would suffice for a lot of things. 3 dB should probably do it for everybody. But give us some headroom, for heaven's sake. And don't clip the input. That's just going to raise the bit. Well, you got a choice. If it's a constant rate coder, it's going to lower the quality. If it's a variable rate coder, it's going to raise the bit rate. But don't clip anything except what you want to do for artistic purposes. You know, I'm not ever going to tell anybody how to do the artistic production. That's what artistic production is. But when you're done with that, don't master it to maximum level. Don't add more clipping. You know, okay, if you have to make a commercial track that's kind of loud, make it kind of loud, but don't overdo those two rails on the end, please. Message of the century. This entire century. This has been true since the beginning of the century.
And get off my lawn.
I tell you now, son. No, actually, I tell the kids, come and play on my lawn, but that's a different thing. Moral of the story. There's some weird stuff out there. There's a couple of ways that people have dealt with intersample overs, but just don't get close, okay? The point of this talk is not there's no basic math in here. The point is that there's a lot of stuff out there that is just wrong. And it's not a good thing. And it makes my life, if I'm going to write something that processes things, it makes my life hard to no good end, to no useful end. You know, I could just as well take something in at 10, in 20, in, I could just be happy to take something in at 24 bits, you know, 12 dB down from peak. I'd be perfectly happy to do that. It wouldn't give you a bit of a noise problem, and it wouldn't give you any of this amazing heartburn. And with that, I'm going to push the switch. Ready, Bob? Sorry, we're a little short on time, so... Yeah, okay, go ahead.
A quick question. It's real interesting to see this presentation and to see what an explanation of what I've sort of empirically stumbled on in doing different versions for different purposes of mastering. But I'm not quite clear. It's totally clear to me about the peak levels for first scale one, but the... you're talking about full scale zero is also being a problem. That's the part that
Max and min. It's max and min. Max and min. Zero is
minimum
fine.
Being minus one, not zero.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Max and min.
Zero is zero crossing in the middle.
Yeah.
Thank you. Zero, a peak at zero, and more or less some slope in a linear slope in a log domain is what you would expect.
Right. Thank you.
It's not what you get sometimes. I mean, the slope of that one thing that I showed is something like 0.3 dB per octave. I mean, that's not even remotely close to log domain.
What was the track that had the almost completely uniform distribution? Or are you revealing the identities of...
I'm not these? Revealing the identity of any of them. And the one that has lots and lots of different clipping points, well... I could probably convey that one, since that one I got off of my own CD, I can probably convey that, but I'll do that privately. I don't want to, I'm not trying to rag on anybody to produce something, I'm just trying to get it fixed.
Did you switch it?
What? I thought I switched it. I guess I didn't. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now you should be coming up.
Hello.
And I'm turning off my mic.
Okay, we'll get on with it here. Time is short. I've got probably over an hour's worth of presentation. I'm going to try and bring it down a bit so that we don't go over our limit here. So be patient with me if I kind of feel like I'm jumping around a little. We're going to look at digital audio at the limit, the observed DAC behavior. It's important to note that what you're going to see here is not contrived measurements like we see with the averaging to get total harmonic distortion and that kind of stuff. We're doing time domain measurements here. This is actual time domain stuff. We're going to see what goes in from a digital audio workstation, what comes out of a real world DAC. So in part one, JJ described the issues created by the digital audio samples close to the limit. In this part, we're going to examine the real world behavior exhibited by a sampling of DACs with various internal DAC ICs. You can see the overview of what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the source of DAC overs, a list of the DACs tested. Then we're going to look at square wave response. I like square wave response because it provides a fair amount of insight into what you can expect out of a particular DAC's performance when it encounters the kind of music that JJ was discussing. Then we're going to move into the measurements that follow with real-world music put into them. So without anything further, let's just briefly review. In the DACs, the components that you buy and you put in your studio, there's a DAC chip usually inside. And this is the architecture of that. What I want to draw your attention to is this section right here. Where'd my mouse go? Is it showing? There we go. This section right here is where the mischief is occurring that we were talking about. Digital audio is coming in here. Some chips provide for some digital gain attenuation. You don't always have control of that, and neither does your customer that's going to be listening to the music. So we're just going to look what's happening here. We're also going to pay a little bit of attention to what goes on at the other side of our DAC, the conversion process, We're going to simplify that path into this. So we've got our digital low-pass filter on the input side of the actual conversion process, and then some analog output buffering. It was talked about earlier, well, the analog stage can clip because we got power supply limits, and the buffer amp might become unstable if it's presented with some challenges. But for the most part, as JJ pointed out earlier, this side is much more well-behaved than this side over here, where we have filter algorithms, and depending upon the software writer, the DSP writer, he may not have taken to heart that part in the code example that said air handling is left as an exercise for the reader and may not deal with underflow, overflow, word wrap, where he should have used saturation arithmetic to mimic the kind of problems that we get out here when you clip. You just go to the top maximum, the bottom maximum. Word wrap, you actually wrap from ratchet from the top rail to the bottom rail and back.
And by the way, saturation isn't necessarily good if you have a multi-step conversion thing. You can also drive stuff nuts there, too.
But it's preferable to word wrap by a large margin.
Yes.
So here's a list of the DACs we tested. I'm giving you the manufacturer's name. This is the box you might buy. Here's the model of the particular ones we're looking at. Here's the list of the companies that make the chips that go inside, and listing the actual chips. These cover a variety of examples. And it's really important to note that even though we can find some bad examples in this presentation, that does not mean categorically that the chip manufacturer is bad. It just means the implementation was bad. And also, we can take a good chip and we can do a bad implementation. So it goes both ways. I'm getting a bit of static over here.
I hear it stems.
Yeah. Go ahead, Lowell.
Okay, we'll get through it. One thing in this list of DACs tested here, the top one, the RME, will only be used for the square wave testing because when we get to the real world examples, I'm using the A to D in that one to do the oversampled measurements of the output of the other DACs. So we won't see it in the music section. So this is our setup. We're taking our digital audio workstation DAC input. You can't quite see it here. A square wave. We're going to send it out to our DAC. The analog section goes to an unusual oscilloscope module that has a higher number of quantization bits available than most oscilloscopes. Most oscilloscopes are 8-bit. Some get to 12. This one's been optimized to get to 15 or 16 for audio work. But yet we still get a very high sample rate. We're going to be sampling at about 9.6 megahertz, coming back, and we'll get our oscillographic display. We'll see just what happened to our square wave going through the process. Here's a blow-up so you can see. This is what I'm putting in. It's a square wave, and I've reduced the range a little bit so you can see it's really hitting the maximum. You can't see those numbers over there, but that's plus maximum, minus maximum. And here's what's coming out. And there's some areas that we're going to be wanting to look at in detail as we look at the square wave output. So we're going to use the ADI2 Pro as our template. And once we get through this and get oriented, the rest of the slides are going to move a little faster. So we're putting 0 dBFS, 44 kilohertz, 16-bit, out to our ADI2 Pro. The ADI2 Pro is an interesting DAC in that you can set the reference level to plus 4 dBU, plus 13 dBU, plus 19 dBU, plus 24 dBU. We're going to set it to plus 4 dBU, which gives us about 3.47 volts peak to peak. On the scale, I know these numbers are small. You can't really see them up here. But this is plus about 3.5 volts peak to peak over the broad portion of the waveform. Now, where we want to pay attention is what's happening here where the filter, the digital filter in particular, is ringing. We have... Yeah, now I have to be back here. Hello. These are the points I want to draw your attention to. In the red circles are the ringing at the... what do I want to say? As we're going up, we overshoot. And the green is where we have a rise and fall. And funny things can happen in that section, too.
No, I'll point out something. This particular DAC is using a constant delay filter. That's why the ring is symmetric about the, pot, the, mm-hmm. the before and after. Because yeah, one of the other ones is not like that, and I'll just point it out.
Yes, you go ahead. Feel free to point it there. Another thing to look at.
That's not bad or good. It just is.
It just is. Another thing to note here is we see a slight downward slope from the rising edge to the falling edge and a slight upward slope from the falling edge to the rising edge. That is indicative of either a DC blocking digital filter or possibly a capacitor in the analog section. It's really great to have DC coupling all the way through as long as you don't have offset, because when you're at minus infinity, if there's an offset sitting there, you're constantly putting energy through your electroacoustic transducers, and that's not a good thing. Now, if we zoom in, we can see that we've got this symmetrical waveform, the pre and post ring, and in this particular case, there's not very much of it. This is a rather good implementation. We're going to see some examples that have a little more ringing, a little less ringing, and different filter algorithms. So we're going to start out with our heavy hitter, the winner of the This Is Bad award. And it's got DC coupling. You can see it's the nice flat lines there. But at first, this looks like a perfect square wave. As you look a little more carefully, you'll see that the peaks, those overshoots are a bit truncated. And the rising and falling edges look a little thick. So as we zoom in, let's see what's going on there. Yeah, we'll zoom in a moment. At minus 3 dBFS, here's the first point. 0 dBFS, we've got this crap happening. At minus 3 dBFS, the overshoot looks about right, and that thickness of the line went away. When we zoom in, this will be much clearer. Here's the thickness of the line. Now, we put in a single transition, but this is what we got out. That's not an artistic addition I think you would appreciate in your music. And you don't have any control over this other than had you used minus 3 dBFS instead of 0 dBFS, you get a reasonable behavior out of that DAC. A little more ringing pre and post, a nice smooth transition, but certainly not all that crap.
Which chip is that?
Well, it's not the chip, it's the implementation. That's the ODAC. That is the Northwest AV guy's end-all, be-all. This is the DAC that's all you need for $100, and it vies with his benchmark for sound quality. But when you get too close to the limit, it doesn't behave the way you would like it to. At 3 dBFS, it behaves appropriately. Now, let's move on to another one. This is the SDAC. This is a collaboration between MassDrop and Race. And we see the same overshoot. We see a nice DC coupled path through. We don't see any thickness of the lines. As we zoom in, hey, this one looks almost like our ADI 2 Pro. This is a better DAC than the ODAC for the same price, or even a little less. However, once again, the point here is not everybody takes and evaluates their DACs at this level and looks at this. We have people out there with all manner and variety of DACs. So, this one would have rendered your 0 dBFS signal pretty well. The previous one wouldn't. Can you predict which one your customer's going to be listening to? Here's minus 3 dBFS. To hit the point home, there's hardly a difference in the amplitude there. And yet, to have that minus 3 dBFS guaranteeing that your other customer got a similar experience is a good thing. Now, we're going to hit a different DAC. This is a Masai MSD-192. It uses a Wolfson chip, which I think is now owned by Cirrus Logic.
I'll point out that this is using a minimum phase filter. You notice on the beginning of the transition, there's no ring. On the end of the transition, there's lots of ring. Again, this isn't good or bad. It just is. But this is using an IIR filter.
And so they call this an appetizing filter in the marketing speak. Some people think this sounds better because there is no pre-ringing. It's all post-ringing, but nothing comes free. If you look at those rings, they're much taller than the other ones. Let's zoom in, and you can see not only is it taller, it lasts longer, but there is no pre-ringing. So it's a trade-off. Nothing comes free.
Yeah, if we also you'll have phase shift as you get closer and closer to half the sampling range.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. It's math. You can't not do it.
So now let's move on to a V800. This is a bielectric V800. I've had this one for years. I like this one. But at 0 dBFS, it too exhibits a bit of crunching there, the truncation at the top and the bottom. There's no funny business in the transitions. As we take it down 3 dBFS, hey, it behaves a little better. Now, two things about the V800, though, that you'll note. If I go back and put this signal in, the clip light comes on. It has a clip light, and it will tell me this is clipping. It also has a digital volume knob. So I can turn it down 3 dB till the clip light goes out. So being the knowledgeable customer I am, I turn it down, and now I'm getting the experience that you intended. But not everybody has that.
And if you'll notice now what's happening there, that clip is actually coming from the op-amp after the DAC.
Which we can see here.
Yeah.
This is what's happening when we're hitting the power supply. So this is happening in the analog section. And all we have to do is turn it down a little bit, and we won't have that problem. 3 dBFS. I keep coming to 3 dBFS. JJ mentioned minus 3 dBFS. There's a common theme going on here. It seems to be a good point that if you keep it below that, you can guarantee a much more consistent behavior. Now we're going to go to the iPhone 4S. I picked the iPhone 4S because I had it, and it has a real connector on it. It's not a lightning connector. I could get easily to it. But you'll see they handle this with a minimum phase filter. They have the overshoot, but the overshoot's clipped. Also, the scale factor here is different. On the y-axis, you'll notice I had to turn the gain up a bit so I could see better what was going on here. So the scale factor's changed on this. This is actually only about a 3-volt peak-to-peak signal. And if we bring it down minus 3 dBFS, hey, look at that. We get a performance that's more consistent with what we would like to see. Here's the ringing, though. This one's interesting. Look at the ringing on this iPhone 4S, and the ring looks a little funny there. I'm not sure, but I think a limiter is hitting, going on and off. As we bring it down 3 dBFS, look how the ring becomes what we expect. Okay, just repeating the list, we're not going to test the ADI-2 Pro. We're going to only look at the 5 when we come into probably the section JJ's a little more interested in. This test setup looks very similar to the previous one, except instead of the oscilloscope in there, we're putting the ADI-2 Pro in. We're putting out a 44 kilohertz 16-bit signal, but we're recording it back at 192 24-bit. And you can see on the left there, I'll use this, on the left, we've got, this is what's going in, and JJ gave this a fond name of Craptastic. And I didn't change it because I thought it was most appropriate. On the bottom here is what we're getting back.
This is the one with the truly artistic level distribution.
So we are leaving ourselves some headroom so we can see what's going to happen when we get the intersample overs. And this one might be a little easier to see, although I don't know if you can see the spikes or not on this one. Yeah, I guess they're there. This is what's going in, 0 dBFS. Coming back, you can see what looks like a line where the 0 dBFS should be, except what's this? And this. And this down here. This. 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 These are spectacular intersample overs. So here we are with the ODAC. That was my example to begin with. And we're going to concentrate on just a couple of spaces in here. We're going to expand them out so you can see in a microscopic level what's happening to your signal. So we're going to go over here and pick about 17 seconds, 17 and a half seconds in. And here we are. This is what's going in. And, oh, right, I've got this clever circling already taking place for me. You see the intersample overs on the upper trace on the negative side on the right channel. And down below, what is this? This came down, you would expect it to just have this nice rounded thing, but it didn't do this nice round thing. It ratcheted back and forth. That's ratcheting back and forth is just as we saw predicted back in our square wave testing. The square wave testing told us that was going to happen. And so we have this happening. We're getting these clicks, rail-to-rail clicks, happening throughout this, throughout our piece, our craptastic, as it's played back through an ODAC. Now here's the SDAC. This is our idealized one. And it's actually pretty reasonably behaved. This looks very similar to what we saw going up here. That's kind of the experience you intended, I suppose. But you can guarantee it between these two users, these two listeners are getting different experiences. Now let's move on to the MOSAI MSD-192. And it has an interesting thing that it does over here. Notice the kind of narrow transition between downward slope and upward slope here. Notice it widened out here and here. And the amplitudes are changed as well.
That's what happens when you limit intermediate stages in the upsampling.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what they're doing. They're saturating every stage in the upsampling. And so you're losing high, basically lose high frequencies when you do that.
And so the math and the response agree here. You get this performance.
Yeah, it's better than wrapping, for sure.
Now in the V800, V800 preserves it pretty well, but notice where the arrows are there. We actually have clipping. This is the analog clipping that's taking place there. That's preferable to some of that other stuff that we saw. But again, it's a different experience. And now the iPhone 4S, what their desire is just throw a limiter in there. And as we look at several places of interest there, notice how this sharp peak broadened out and lowered. Broadened out and lowered. In fact, look at this one here. You had a transition down and up that changed to this. You hit a limiter in the iPhone 4S.
That's a soft clipper.
And this is a smart device. Lots of smart devices have this. Now again, I'm trying to reiterate. I've just got examples here. And these examples are representative of a lot of other devices out there. So I can't just say, well, hey, that's a bad one, so don't buy that brand because they're all bad. This is just the world out there. This is what you have to pay attention to as the producer, the mastering engineer, the last guy that touches it, what you're going to give your customers.
Well, I know that Apple does processing of the audio before it hits DAC to compensate for their speakers, and that might change with every software update.
It can. But you can turn some of that stuff off. Okay, here's another thing to think about on those chips. The chips have, when you program the chip, there's a gazillion configurations that you have to go through and manage. There's a bunch of parameters. If you go check the data sheet out, you'll find the 200 pages that tell you how to program the chip.
Okay.
As the coder, you've got to set that chip up how you want to perform. And you make some choices on what kind of performance you want out of it. Somebody didn't configure it the best way possible. So that was my point earlier.
Okay.
That chip, which I think is the ES9023, and he's got two of them in there, I don't think was configured appropriately for dealing with clip behavior. Of course, maybe never expected that. Obviously never threw a square wave at it to see what would happen. And so here we are back to that one, craptastic another one. And here's our wonderful peak-to-peak rail changing this to that on the right channel. SDAC did much better. Again, they probably knew what they were doing. Grace has a long history of pro audio work. They have a better handle on what to do in both the digital filters, how to configure the chips, and what to do in the analog world. The MSD-192, once again, we see the broadening between the transitions here. This got changed to this, morphed into that. And the V800, we hit our analog limiting there. iPhone 4S, well, we really made some changes here to keep that level down, and we hit the limiter.
That actually has some saturation in the DAC, too.
Mm-hmm.
So they're doing a couple things there.
So let's look at the spectrum. We talked about that earlier. This is our ODAC spectrum. This is the only one I'm going to bring up as an example. We've resampled it, in this case, 192, so we should have 96 kilohertz all the way up here to the black. And this is, as you would expect, about 22 kilohertz here. Almost everything is at 22 kilohertz except for these spikes that you see in here in the spectrum. And those spikes are where some of the most egregious intersample overs are occurring. So let's look at the time domain again. We're going to pay attention to these rather odd transitions and look at that little segment, the same segment in the frequency domain. We got 3 millisecond bombs going off there above 22 kilohertz, all the way up to 96 kilohertz. And that's what you're presenting to your amplifier downstream. Hopefully it is either limited or will be stable when it deals with that, but that's what you're giving it. So I mentioned square waves earlier. You guys say, well, yeah, that's nice, but you don't listen to square waves, or do you? Here's a timbale. This timbale's got, that's the whole recording of the single hit. It's been set to 0 dBFS, and this is at 44 kilohertz, 16-bit. We're going to focus on this section right there. I was going to do a live demo here, but in the interest of time, we won't do it. So we're going to focus on this section and expand it out. And this is what we see. And again, this is a little hard to see, unfortunately, with the lights. But you can see the... would you douse them a bit? I really want them to see this section. If you just get the front ones off or something. There we go. Can you see that better now? All right. The very leading edge over here is just a single sample transition. This one makes a transition in a single sample. Again here, and I think even the next one over is just a couple samples. That's an awful lot like a square wave, right? At the beginning, those first four transitions of the timbale. And we're going to pass that out to our oscilloscope. That's what I had set up here. These slides will serve. This is what we get back. And as we predicted with the oscilloscope, we got a truncated overshoot. We've got this crap taking place ratcheting. This is not at all what we sent. This is what we sent. This is what we got back. That's what this user is going to hear. And if we zoom in, we can definitely see the same stuff we saw in the square wave response happening on a timbale. Now, if we go to minus 3 dBFS, notice how we got our ringing back. This cleaned up on the transitions, the rising and falling edges. They cleaned up a whole bunch. And now when we zoom in, this looks pretty much like what we expected out of our source. So we're getting a much more faithful reproduction. When we hit the SDAC at 0 dBFS, yeah, we didn't expect any trouble. The square waves predicted we wouldn't have any, and we didn't. And we zoom in, we see that still holds true. Now, I'd like to just point out that at the minus 3 dBFS, if we hit we go down, we hardly pay any penalty in amplitude, and we maintain the same level of cleanliness. So where am I here? Okay, this is what I want to do now. Is if we say at minus 3 dBFS, what's our experience consistency between the person listening to the ODAC and the person listening to the SDAC? As I flip back and forth between these two, you can see those two are very, very close to one another in the faithfulness of their reproduction. When we hit 0 dBFS, there's a considerable difference between the experience those two users get. The gain is somewhat different because of the overshoot. The SDAC accounted for the overshoot, so he wouldn't end up with the truncation. No, there's no AGC. This is the SDAC. He set his 0 dBFS such that it's got a lot of... He probably set his amplifier such that 0 dBFS with a sinusoid was going to just hit maximum on the amplifier. He's got that to deal with, truncating the overshoot. And the SDAC didn't do that. They left some headroom so that the overshoot wouldn't truncate. No, it's not automatic gain control. It's how you're setting the gain straight out to your... When I set a fixed gain, I say, hey, look, I'm going to let the DAC output go plus and minus 2 volts peak to peak, but I'm going to set my op amp or my buffer at plus and minus 3 volts peak to peak with my rails. So I've got a 1 volt headroom on both sides. There's no gain change going on there. I just allowed for more room there. Then the... ODAC guy says, oh, no, I can get away with an amplifier that's just plus or minus 2 volts and my rails, and my DAC is plus or minus 2 volts rails. I won't worry about it because I don't worry about overshoots.
It's just that it appears that the maximum to the minimum, the difference is about the same between the two waveforms. The rails, the difference between the rails are the same, but the rest of the waveform... Clearly, that's a louder waveform than the other. That's gained up. That waveform is gained up.
Okay, let me try this again.
Even the features are bigger. The feature bumps are bigger.
Okay. If I had a 0 dBFS sign to present you here, you would see that between the two of them, it would be the same. But because I'm using a square wave here, and we're hitting the rails, we're having some different behaviors. Now, this is the ODAC. There's the SDAC. Between the two, we've just allowed more headroom on the SDAC than we did on the ODAC.
Yes. And that's equivalent to having a fixed headroom and changing the gain.
Okay, but that's not how they did it. So if I was drawing for you an op-amp circuit here, post-DAC, I would have rails that are higher to allow for the headroom, and on the other one, they didn't allow for that. So anyway, however we get there, the most important closing thought here is the DAC behavior above 3 dBFS varies considerably among vendors and models. Leaving headroom is more likely to result in a consistent experience across the DACs. And that's the message I want you to walk away with. Is it 5 different DACs, 5 different experiences? You can't guarantee what you're going to get, but when you bring it down to within 3 dBFS, you get a much more consistent behavior across all the DACs, and that's a take home. Questions?
Mom, I saw cell phone. Would this apply equally, or at least could it apply equally to, benchmark and that sort of thing?
You know, that's why I bring these in and measure them, because it's all dependent upon how did they implement it? What did they do? What did they do in their analog design? Did they leave headroom? Did they configure the chip? These guys, at the very beginning, let's see if I can go back to one above this, one down. You'll notice that there are several people using AKMs in there. There are different series in there. But you can get two people using the 4490 and get different results out of it. You can get two different people using the ESS 9023 or a 9018 and get different results depending upon how they configured it during their programming and what analog circuitry they put around it, what kind of clock they provided it with. So there's a lot goes into these things. That's why we spend time measuring them and seeing what comes out and see how good a job they did. Other questions?
What was that scope, the Picotech? What's the model number on
that? Oh, a 5243B.
Cool.
That's an unusual one. It goes to 100 megahertz, doesn't go up to the gigahertz, but what you get instead is you get to have 15 or 16 good bits, depending upon whether you use one or two channels, that you can use for your quantization levels to do this kind of investigation. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.